This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Howie Franklin holds the record as the flight attendant to serve the most U.S. presidents on Air Force One. He got started during the Ford administration and finished his career four presidents later with Bill Clinton. Howie's written an autobiography called Yes, Sir, Mr. President, to share his memories aboard Air Force One. Howie has since retired from the military but is still in aviation. He is now the director of the Cape Fear Regional Jetport in Southport, and he joins us from WHQR in Wilmington. Howie Franklin, welcome to the State of Things.
It's a beautiful day on the beach.
Well, it's not bad in the Piedmont either, but we can't go swimming quite as quickly. So tell us, and speaking of swimming quite as quickly, you grew up, I want to get to your experiences on Air Force One. In fact, I want to find out how you got there. You grew up kind of a privileged upbringing on Long Island, hobnobbing with the rich and famous. Tell us about your earlier days.
Yeah, my family had a house at Ocean Beach Fire Island, and it was a normal thing to see movie stars and news people and things of that nature in the area. In fact, one of the first marital arguments I ever witnessed in my life was with Mike Wallace.
Okay.
Mike Wallace.
Whoa.
Yeah, Mike Wallace and his wife named Buff Todd. That was my. Here I am crabbing along the dock, and I come upon these two people having a major argument. So there was Mike Wallace. There was Dave Garraway from the Today Show, the movie stars Marilyn Monroe, Joe DiMaggio, and I was around that, and I took it as normal. But when I was 16, I did have an epiphany. I realized that my family owned the house, and they were renting.
there you go. And yet, you couldn't really treat them as renters, could you? I mean, you actually found yourself in service of those folks at one point, right?
Yeah, when I was 16, I got a job at Talisman Yacht Club on the eastern end of Fire Island for the jet set. That would be like the top 1%ers nowadays. Mm-hmm. And the guests of these people were like Carol Channing and Ray Charles and people like that. But these were the jet setters of the 60s, and I worked for them. I worked for a French chef, an Italian chef, a Greek chef, a Hungarian chef that worked as the Fontainebleau in Florida. And she was a Jewish lady who was in a Jewish concentration camp and had the tattoo on her arm. And amazing listening to this lady's stories and things. And so I grew up with these people, and I realized, you know, if you do a good job and you try to and you have a good attitude, you can take you a long ways. And I also realized that these people are real people. They're normal people, even though they're very wealthy and powerful. You know, they cry, they feel things and things of that nature.
So it really set you up. Yeah, well, it does. It does prepare you for a life with a lot of famous people, including presidents and all of the people who would be on Air Force One. So it's pretty good prep, not to mention food prep. All of that is kind of early on. You were drafted in 65, and you had no intention what you decided to go into the Air Force rather than the Army, right? Tell us about some of the decisions you made in 65.
Well, yeah, I was drafted. And I was 20 years old, and you know, Vietnam was hot and heavy. Me and my friends realized, I went to the Army recruiter and I said to the Army recruiter, if I enlist, it was 3 years, and if I get drafted, it's 2 years. I said, if I enlist and I'm a volunteer, do I get any better chance of getting the career field that I like? And I was very lucky. I had a wonderful sergeant looked at me and he said, son, and he said, in the Army, no matter how high you you test, you always test highest in the infantry.
So I see. So yeah, I get it. Yeah, so it's better than to enlist.
Yeah, well,
outside of the Army.
Yeah, and we found out the United States Air Force, and I joked with General Kulak about this, the former commandant of the Marine Corps. I said, he asked me why I joined the Air Force. I said, well, I figured out, sir, in 1965, the Air Force was the only armed forces in the United States of America that the enlisted man was not the primary resource to get shot. And that was a serious consideration.
Mm-hmm. So, and now you actually became a flight attendant early on in the Air Force, more or less, right? Tell us about that.
Well, I was working, and I put in for food service, and I got what I wanted. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be, but I ended up in an in-flight kitchen on Guam. Flight crew people kind of liked my personality, and they wanted me to cross-train. And I said, well, what do I have to do? They said, well, you're going to have to extend 8 months over your four-year commitment. I said, wait a minute, you got the wrong guy. I can't do that. No way. So they said, well, let's take you on one flight and see how you like it. So I said, well, I'm getting off Guam. That's good. So I went to Okinawa for about 24 or 48 hours. Then I went to Taipei, Taiwan for 5 days. Had a great time. The crew members appreciated what I did on the airplane. They treated me with respect. It was the difference was I was surrounded by people that liked what they did.
Mm.
And that made a big difference. And I came back off the trip, and they said, well, what are you going to do? And I didn't really know. I didn't want to extend. I didn't want to stay, go over four. And they said, well, you know, you have to go to personnel to get your per diem. And I said, what's per diem? They said, well, they paid you so much a day to go on this trip. I said, wait a minute, you paid me? I would have paid you. Yeah. So from there, I end up signing over and worked for some generals. And the generals eventually pushed me into the 89th Military Airlift Wing in 1970 at Andrews Air Force Base. But nope. I had a lot of background and things that other people in my career field didn't have. So I was able to use that to my advantage.
Well, background, you tested in, you made some wise choices. But there are a couple of pieces of fried chicken that helped your career early on, too. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I found out I was in Rapid City, South Dakota, and I found out I was getting a shipment to Guam. And I said, boy, I didn't like Rapid City, South Dakota. So I talked to a friend of mine that had just come back from Guam. And I said, how was it? He said, hey, I'm glad to get back to South Dakota. I said, oh, my God. So I said to him, you know, what job should I look for? He said, try to get in the in-flight kitchen. And if you get an in-flight kitchen, you have to have a driver's license. So I was working in a ration breakdown area where I took care of a lot of people going to missile sites. Transportation guy came in. I said, hey, I need a driver's license. And he says, okay, what do you got to trade? I said, well, I just cooked three chickens here. He said, well, that's good enough. He come back and he gave me a driver's license. The only problem was it said I could drive everything in the Air Force, even a missile truck.
For three pieces, a couple of chickens. Yeah. So that's how it works. That's disturbing, but let's move on and find out. I'm sure things have changed quite a bit now.
Yes.
tell us how you worked that, parlayed all of that into actually being aboard Air Force One. How do you make that transition?
Well, I got to the 89th Military Airlift Wing, and I traveled with the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. First Secretary of State was William Rogers, and Secretary of Defense was Melvin Laird. And then we graduated to have a new Secretary of Defense, who was Henry Kissinger. And I got to tell you, he was the greatest trainer I ever had. If anybody can, where you can work for Henry Kissinger, you work for anybody. He was demanding. He expected a lot. And our challenges of going all over the world at any moment continually challenged us. I was on a trip with Dr. Kissinger in South America in 1976, and a phone call came into to the airplane from the chief flight attendant, Charlie Palmer, on Air Force One. Said when I come back off the mission, he'd like to talk to me. And when he did, he said, you know, I'd like to offer you the job on Air Force One, but it's 6 months before the elections, and I can't guarantee you're going to be able to keep the job because they could change the whole crew. If you're willing to take that risk, we'd like to hire you. So in 1976, April 76, I got hired on Air Force One. Now, I used to fly with President Ford as vice president, and he was appointed to the job 6 months before I was. And when I got on the crew, President Ford grabbed my jacket. And he said, Howie, remember, I got here first.
But you lasted longer, Howie.
Yeah, I never expected it.
You stayed in the job longer than he did. So tell us more about what the flight attendant does, because you're in charge of the food on those planes and meals, right?
Yeah, well, the mission of Air Force One is to provide secure and safe air transportation for the president, first and foremost. Second of all, Air Force One is to try to provide all the services that the White House would provide for the president and the staff as it's traveling throughout the world. My job is to try to provide a comfortable but professional atmosphere. Professional, but still comfortable. We wanted it when you walked back on Air Force One and you were in Beijing, China, that you felt like you were home again. And we worked very diligently at that. We were responsible for all the food and all the services on the airplane. And not only to make sure that they were quality and people enjoyed them, but also has it been tampered with. So, I mean, if you know, the food's got to be correct. We have to check the food, make sure that's correct. But you know, the toothpaste and the mouthwash and the candy and whatever, the chewing gum, everything I was responsible that hadn't been tampered with and wouldn't make somebody sick.
Well, and that means, you know, sometimes, obviously, in the United States, that's a little bit easier, but you're taking the president all over the place. And then sometimes he's there for a while. So you have to go buy food in local markets, right?
Yeah, and if we were in places where the local markets weren't up to what we considered our standards, we would go to the American embassies. And in fact, the American embassies, they would be brought their goods in certain one or two times a month. And when we walked in the door, I walked in the door, they'd scream, "Oh, no, we're going to lose us.
We're going to lose everything." Well, this is important, I think. Shuttle diplomacy, you know, if you think about that in these uncertain times, you talked about Kissinger and you're hopping from one country to another and he doesn't know where he's going next during that difficult period. President, same thing. He might be on the ground for a little while. So this presents problems for you for food storage, right?
Yeah. Well, one of the things, I'll give you an example. I wasn't on the trip, but when Richard Nixon left China, the airplane had been on the ground for a long time, and everything on that 707, it was either frozen or it was canned goods. And what I understand, Barbara Walters asked, she didn't like the meal. It was kind of a heavy, fat meal, and she asked for something else, and I heard the flight attendant served her spam sandwich.
That's the last time she'll ask for her own meal.
Although she reported on the Today Show, I got a spam sandwich on Air Force One. But it was the fact that they couldn't go to the local markets. That was the thing. They had canned goods or frozen things, and it was that was the case.
So do you have to give them the safety message every time, or is that waived because, you know, it's the president?
No, we have there's a piece of paper, informational card that everybody sees.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you have to get a verbal? Do you have to get a verbal yes in English?
No.
Okay, good. No. That could be rough on some of those flights because there are a lot of people on the plane. So let's talk about some of these. As you say, you started out on Air Force One with Gerald Ford. You knew him before. What do you remember about him?
Homespun Michigan gentleman. And, you know, you realize he didn't have the ego of an elected president. Anybody gets elected, even in your hometown, it's a real good feeling. But he was appointed, and he took his job very serious. One myth I'd like to bust, I mean, he goes down in history of being a klutz because he fell and hit something, and Saturday Night Live took that. But he was probably one of the better athletes of any president that we ever had. He was an avid snow skier. He was an athlete. Played football for Michigan. He fell that first time in Salzburg, Austria, going down the steps, and from then he had hit his head in going on to the Marine One helicopter. I've done that. I think President Obama has even done that. But when it rolls that way, they can't defend themselves. They just got to let it go. Okay. But I think that was a real myth.
I've spent a lot of time in the book talking about President Reagan. Obviously, Hollywood actor, seems gregarious. So behind the scenes, what's he like, on a long flight when you got to circle? No, he never has to circle the airport, I guess.
Well, you know, I didn't know. I didn't know what we were going to get. And I knew a little bit of his history. And anything I say about presidents or first ladies or anything, it's got nothing to do with politics. These are my personal experiences and how I was able to perceive those. So I unfairly tried to catch Ronald Reagan being something that we didn't see on television. I mean, I woke him up and put him to bed and saw him behind the scenes, and he came across totally sincere all the time. And I remember telling Stu Spencer, who was one of the big gentlemen that ran the campaigns for the Republicans, I said, you know, this guy's one heck of a politician. He said, you know how he really isn't. He's just one of the nicest guys you ever met in your life.
Mm-hmm. And it came across apparently to the American public as well, or to a majority of them. Talk about, and before that, Jimmy Carter, the idea, I mean, you talked about your per diem in the military and a little surprise that you would get paid extra for, you know, doing your job. There was a change under the Carter administration for all of the passengers on Air Force One, right? Tell us about that.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize everybody on Air Force One that's on there, including the crew, gets charged for their meals. We go out and buy a meal, and we divide it by the number of people that we're serving, and that comes out with a price. Now, you're not billed if you don't eat the meal. That was the only administration in the past and even now that ever came to the point where they wanted us to present the bill at the end of the day so they could okay it and sign it off. I think a little bit had to do with Jody Powell. Jody Powell was the press secretary for President Carter. And what I understand, he was he didn't like the Air Force too much because he had some problems in the Air Force Academy. And I think he thought we were cheating him. I don't know how we could cheat him. So at the end of the day, we'd have to have him sign it. But everybody on Air Force One gets per diem, so they're paid for their meals and they pay for their drinks, everything. It actually works out very well.
The meals got a little fancier in the Reagan administration. Michael Deaver said he wanted the quality of the fare to improve, and there's a great story around that.
Yeah, Charlie Palmer, my chief, went down to the White House, and they wanted to increase the quality of the meals. Well, we're willing to do that, but you have to pay for it. And the meals on Air Force One, we get dinged once in a while because they're kind of like the type of meals you'd go to a homespun restaurant. If you went to Philadelphia and you come out of Philly, you're going to get a Philly cheesesteak, yeah. You know, things of that nature. But he wanted upgraded, and we're okay, but you got to pay for it. So the one meal, we were going to Canada. It was the first meal. It was a lobster Thermidor meal coming out of Canada, going home. And I was working in the front galley. And my Charlie Palmer came to me, and he was a little, I could see a little intenseness. And what happened is Michael Deaver had ordered a corned beef sandwich, and he's the one that ordered this big, expensive meal. So my chief wasn't too happy that the man who ordered the expensive meal was now getting a $5 sandwich, and everybody else got to pay for their meals.
But I'd have told him you're out of corned beef and giving him spam, but that's me. I'm a little contrary.
Yeah, well, we didn't have any corned beef for some reason because I found out the guy that worked there before me didn't like corned beef. But anyway.
Now, here's the thing. They got to be bigger, and you've got some great stories about bathrooms, including a line that formed one day. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think this is probably a great example of our country. early in the Reagan administration, President Sadat got assassinated over in Egypt. President Reagan sent a delegation to the funeral, and a delegation where people had interacted with President Sadat. So our pasture load, first of all, the Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, and he was in the stateroom with his own bathroom. Then the conference room was Caspar Weinberger with his staff. Now, the staff area where the working staff would sit had these VIPs. It had Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon is now sitting with where Mr. Ehrlichman and Mr. Haldeman used to sit in the staff area. President Carter and Mrs. Carter and President Ford and Henry Kissinger in the staff area. As I walked by, Henry grabbed my coat and he said, "Howie, you finally did it. You got me in Sturridge."
But there's also, at this point, they can't use the other bathrooms that they had been entitled to as president. So now they got to use a different bathroom. And actually, there was a little line, right? President Carter.
Yeah, well, the funny thing was, I just worked for President Carter as my commander-in-chief. And we're going across the Atlantic, and he comes up to me, nature calls, and asks me, "Howie, can I use the crew bathroom?" Well, it was a little startling at first. But I escorted him to the crew bathroom and said, "Sure." But then I realized immediately the reason where he was sitting, his bathroom was located in the back of the airplane. And to go back there, he's got to walk past Helen Thomas and Sam Donaldson and the boys. And he didn't want to do that. So he came up front to use the crew bathroom. So he was in the bathroom. And the next thing you know, President Ford walked up. And President Ford asked me if he could use the crew bathroom. I said, "Yes, sir, but it's occupied right now." And so we're chit-chatting because the radio operator and myself, we knew President Ford, and we're chit-chatting. Next thing you know, here comes Henry Kissinger. Now, think about it. I'm sitting there saying this is a moment in history. And Alexander Haig, who's in the stateroom, has his own bathroom, used to work for every one of these people in one capacity or the other. And when President Carter, he was the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe under President Carter.
Yeah, Haig.
He's got his own bathroom, and now the presidents are using my bathroom. Well, that's fine. So anyway, but Henry doesn't ask. He walks right up, looks in the door, sees it's occupied, comes back. And we're now chit-chatting with President Ford and the radio operator, Jerry Rankin. Finally, Henry says to me, "You know, the discipline in the military is slipping." And I said, "Yes, sir. Why is that?" He said, "Because all you gentlemen used to be scared to death of me." And he said, "I'm going to go back and tell Cappy," was Caspar Weinberger. And so we all kind of chuckled. Finally, President Henry Kissinger turned to me and he said, "Howie, who the heck's in the bathroom?" And I don't think he said heck. And I said, "Well, it's President Carter, sir." And he took a book with him. Henry says, "Get his butt out of there." I said, "No, sir, we can't do that." Now, remember, I got Al Haig in the stateroom. I got President Carter in the bathroom, President Ford waiting online for the crew bathroom, and Henry Kissinger.
Howie Franklin, retired Air Force One flight. You're going to have to read the book to find out more. Howie Franklin, the book is called Yes, Sir, Mr. President. Thanks so much, Howie Franklin, for talking with us.
Hey, you did a great job. Thank you.
Just ahead, what can Confederate monuments tell us about the evolution of American memory? We'll look into it on the state of things in a moment. Stay tuned.